Great. So today I'm going to continue talking about approximability of CSPs, in particular, keep focusing on algorithms for approximation. And as I mentioned before, the next two lectures by Venkat will be concerned with hardness of approximation. Still okay? Okay, so I'll remind you of where we were last time and where we left off. So last time when we left off, we were talking about given any CSP, let me call it CSP gamma. Well, we were concerned with the question of how well you can approximate it and how well you can efficiently satisfy as many constraints as you can. I'll just remind you of the key definition. It's right up here. We say that an algorithm alpha out of beta approximates the CSP if it has the following guarantee. Whenever the input instance, thanks, has optimal value at least beta, meaning that the best assignment, whatever it is, satisfies at least a beta fraction of the given constraints, then the algorithm is guaranteed to output an assignment that has value at least alpha, an alpha fraction of the constraints. And again, if the algorithm is randomized by its value, we mean it's the expectation of its value over its randomness. Okay, and so in order to attack this algorithmically, we propose this particular basic linear programming relaxation, or LP relaxation, for the problem. And I'll remind you what it said. It's a little bit complicated, but we'll go over it one more time. So it's an optimization problem which can be solved efficiently. And you don't really need to know why for the purpose of this talk. Just take my word for it if you don't know that in polynomial time, you can solve this optimization problem exactly. Okay. So what does it say? Well, there's a couple of things that it's trying to optimize over. Let's start with the easiest one, which is maybe this one. One thing the LP is sort of looking to find is the probability distribution on domain values, on labels, for each variable v. And that probability distribution we'll write as mu sub v. The other thing it's seeking is the probability distribution also on sort of local assignments. So for every constraint c, you'll have such a probability distribution. And if the constraint c has scope s, that's like a tuple of variables, then this is a probability distribution on assignments to just that tuple of variables. Okay? We're going to do the SAT example again in a second. And finally, when it's optimizing these two things, you know, they're not completely independent from one another. They should also satisfy this condition that says they're sort of consistent in some way. Okay, so what this condition says is that for every constraint which has some scope, and for every variable in that scope, and for every label in that domain, there's some probability mass that lambda c, this probability distribution for this constraint, assigns to or gives to local assignments that set variable v to value l. So this notation is the probability when capital L is drawn from this distribution that it's assigning label little l to v. And that should be consistent with these guys. So it should be also the same number as the probability mass that the mu's are assigning to v. Excellent question. Yes, it gives a distribution where all assignments, satisfying and unsatisfying. But you know, here's the dramatic conclusion of the explanation. What the LP is trying to maximize is sort of the amount of probability mass it puts on satisfying assignments. So you average over all constraints. For each constraint, you look at how much of the probability mass for this lambda c is it assigning to satisfying constraints, and that's how much you sort of get. And any questions about that? No more questions? Okay, so as we saw last time, you can solve this efficiently, and it's a relaxation. So this value is always at least the optimal value of the program of the CSP. And hopefully in some cases, in particular this case we'll examine, it's not too much bigger. And so it can be used as a good approximation to the optimal value. So here's the theorem that I wrote down that we'll prove now. So it's for the max SAT problem. And if you want, you can make it max K SAT for some finite K, so you don't have to worry about how big this linear program is, but never mind about that. So it's about a specific algorithm for max SAT or max K SAT. And here's the algorithm. It's two lines. First, solve the linear program optimally and get back, you know, a solution L, which has these variable distributions and constraint distributions, which is optimal, and it achieves some LP value. And now you have to produce, you know, an actual assignment to the variables. So you create one randomly, and you do it in sort of the most obvious way, you know, guided by the variable distributions. So for each variable v, you just take this distribution, mu sub v, which is some probability on 1 and some probability on 0, and you just, you know, pick f of v according to that distribution. And you do this independently for all v. Okay, so that's a randomized algorithm that outputs some variable assignment. And this is the theorem, this is the claim that it's a pretty good approximation algorithm. So no matter what the optimum value is beta, this algorithm in expectation gets at least a 1 minus 1 over e fraction of it, which is some 63%. No, that is a reasonable thing to consider. Maybe that would be an equally natural strategy to look at mu v and say it has more probability on mass on 1, go with 1, and if it has more probability mass on 0, go with 0. But this is a bit more, it's a bit less decisive than that. So if mu v has 75% probability mass on 1 and 25% on 0, then your algorithm will set f of v to be 1 with probability 75% and 0 with probability 25%. Okay. So any more questions about the statement? Yeah. No.
Right.
No, they're not. Definitely not. Won't be product distributions in general.
But then when you do this trick at the end, when you sample these values, it looks like you do it for product distributions.
Kind of, yes. I mean, this LP gives you what it gives you, and now this is where sort of the standard part of the algorithm that you apply for any CSP you're tackling. And you get back these two objects with this kind of condition that ties them together and this measure of the quality based on the constraint distributions. And now here comes the creative part of the algorithm. I mean, it's up to you what to do with these things in an attempt to sort of guide you to come up with an actual solution that has value somehow comparable to the LP value. And so, you know, this is sort of the creative step of the algorithm. And, well, it's not that creative. It sort of does sort of the most obvious thing. And you could think about it as these mu v's as forming a product distribution on the variables, but you're only drawing from it once anyway. So I don't know if that clarified your question. Any more questions? Yep. Yeah, in practice, that's actually a very good idea. So what I'll show actually is that if you just draw from it once, in expectation, you'll get, I don't know, 63%. Let's assume it was satisfiable. Yeah, so as I said before, you could de-randomize it if you want and deterministically get at least 63%. But it's probably actually even better to do exactly what you suggested and draw from it a bunch of times. And probably you'll get something that's bigger than 63% though, sometimes. So that's a reasonable strategy. More questions? We can't prove that you'll get anything better than just the 63%. Yeah. Okay, so now I'll prove this. Okay, so we need to analyze, you know, this is our strategy for producing F. We need to analyze for each clause. I mean, the natural way to analyze is to look at every single clause and say, what's the probability that F satisfies this particular clause? So, as an example, suppose one clause in the instance is, I don't know, X, or not Y, or Z. Okay, so what's the probability, this is just an experiment, what's the probability over the choice of F that F satisfies C? Can somebody tell me? Tony? Pardon me? No, it depends on the distribution's mu v. So it's a function of these mu v guys. If all the mu v's were half, then that would be 7/8. Yeah, I'm hearing the right answer now. So it's 1 minus the probability it fails to satisfy it, which is the probability that F picks exactly the wrong label for X, Y, and Z. So I guess that'd be 1 minus mu X of 0 times mu Y of 1 times mu Z of 0. Make sense? Because you're doing it also independently for each of the variables. Okay, I hope that's clear. So let's do it in general now. So generally, say that C of the clause and that let's write B. How shall I write it? B sub C mapping S to 0, 1 for the bad or forbidden assignments. Okay. So then the thing we have is that, of course, the probability that probability over the choice of F, S draw, that F satisfies C is 1 minus the product over the variables in the scope of mu of that variable of the bad guy there. Okay, it proves to be a bit of notation, but that's what it is, I think. Does everybody agree with that? Okay. Let's call that star. We'll come back to it. Okay. So our task, this is sort of for each clause, this is the probability that this algorithm is going to assign it, and it's what we're trying to analyze. So we're going to need to relate it to this, the value of the LP solution. Okay, so given this constraint again, how much does this LP solution L that we solve for contribute to the LP value on this constraint? See, it goes into every constraint contributes to the LP. So we need to look at the probability. Now, this is the probability where L, drawn from this constraint distribution, that L of S satisfies R. Okay, let me call this P sub C. This is the only sort of trick in the whole proof. I'm fixing C. I'm right now working on a constraint-by-constraint basis, so I'm fixing C, and its relation is R, and its scope is S. Good, thanks. When is you draw this partial assignment for this scope from this distribution, when does it satisfy R? R is a disjunction, right? It's a disjunction over some variables. So, it satisfies the disjunction if it satisfies the first literal or the second literal or the third literal, et cetera. Okay? So this is like the probability of a disjunction. So we can use the union bound, right? The probability of the disjunction of events is at most the sum of the probabilities of the events. Okay? So let me write that down. It's at most the sum over the variables in the scope of the probability, again, when you draw from this constraint distribution, that the value that L assigns to this variable is not the bad value, which is B sub C of B. Okay. So this is the event that the sort of local assignment of this clause on variable V is not the bad value. And if any of those events happen, then L will satisfy R. Okay, this is the union bound. Any question about that? Okay, so now we use this guy. So we're going to relate. So now we're talking about the constraint distributions. We'd like to relate it back to the variable distribution. So we use this guy. Actually, let me just, instead of it saying L of V equals BCV, let me just say it's. Never mind. Yeah, it's not the same thing. So why is it not the same thing? So these lambda c's are probability distributions, but the algorithm never, like the algorithm, nobody ever actually draws for them. We're sort of just reasoning about them. This is with respect to the randomness of the algorithm. So it's a random thing that generates all assignment for every variable. And right now we're just fixing a particular variable and looking at the probability that f satisfies it. But that's exactly what we want to do. We want to relate this probability somehow to exactly this probability. So it's not the same thing, but we'd like to relate them. So this key condition that ties the two objects together says that we can replace. See, now this is just talking about the probability that this local distribution L assigns some value to a variable V. So this is actually exactly the sum over V and S. I'm not going to change that line. The probability, well, in fact, just the probability mass that mu V assigns to the opposite of BCD. I guess I've combined the two steps here. I mean, this is also equal to the thing in the middle is the probability mass of mu sub V assigns to the negation of BCD. And okay, so this is the other key step. So it's got us from talking about these constraint distributions to the variable distributions. And now we're happier. We just want to relate this quantity with this star quantity. And we're looking in okay shape because at least they're talking about the same numbers, these mu sub v's. Yeah, so this line was precisely by dagger, if I call this dagger. So now, conceptually, I've done everything in the proof. I was going to say the rest is just algebra, but maybe that's a bad word. The rest is just arithmetic. Okay, so we want to compare this number now with star. Let's save this board. Okay, so now I'll do the arithmetic. So on one hand, you see there's a product involved down here, and I guess there's a sum up here. So we're going to use the arithmetic mean, geometric mean inequality. So I'll do that for you. So this star, well, there it is. It's 1 minus the product of a bunch of numbers. Okay, so I'll just write that as 1 minus it's how many numbers are involved? Cardinality of S numbers. So I'm going to write this as the geometric mean of those numbers raised to the power of S. This is just arithmetic tricks. I'm going to take the geometric mean over all variables in the scope of these numbers, mu sub v, the bad assignment to v, raised to the power of s. It's just the definition of the geometric mean. And now we'll use the inequality. The geometric mean is less than or equal to the arithmetic mean, so there's a subtraction. So this is at least 1 minus the arithmetic mean. Same thing. Cardinality of S. And now if you take the average of a bunch of numbers and you subtract them from 1 and take the average of that, I'll just write it. So this is equal to 1 minus 1 minus the arithmetic mean, again over V and S, of 1 minus these numbers. Okay, the average of 1 minus the numbers is 1 minus the average of those numbers. And that's great. I mean, all this was done because now we finally have this term involved. Okay, just say this is the sum of a bunch of numbers, s of them. So it's a cardinality of s times their arithmetic mean. Stop. Okay, so actually, this thing here is P sub C over S. Okay. Thank you. Yeah, because there's a less than or equals up there. Good. Yeah, this one's all, I think this is all okay. Question about that derivation? Good. Now we're almost done. So to finish this, it just depends on sort of how careful you want to be about the calculation. So you see, the extent to which you can relate these two guys depends on the size of the clause. Okay, so for example, the size of the clause is, let me put the P sub C here. And this is 1 minus G, 1 minus P sub C over S, the S. Okay, if S is 1, this is just P sub C. So 0, 1, 1. This is S equals 1. And this quantity is, it looks like this. Well, yeah. This is S equals 2. S equals 3. And it goes to a limit, but it looks like this. In particular, I leave it to you as an exercise to check that this is a concave function of P sub C for all S. In particular, it's above this line. And this value here, you take P sub C to be 1, this goes to, P sub C is 1, this goes to 1 minus 1 over E. Okay, I guess all I'm saying here is that this is the line 1 minus 1 over E times P sub C, then all these curves are above it. So this is, okay, a simple fact that you can check for yourself. This is at least 1 minus 1 over E times P sub C. So I erased what star was, but what we eventually concluded is that probability that F satisfies a particular clause C is at least 1 minus 1 over E times this P sub C, and this is exactly P sub C right here. And so, you know, LP value, this L is the average over all C of this P sub C. And so therefore, the expected value of the choice of F it's the average of these numbers, so it's at least the average over C, 1 minus 1 over E times P sub C, which is at least 1 minus 1 over E times the LP value of L. Okay, I guess that's what we were trying to prove. Questions about that? No? Probably you have a question, right? Okay. Actually, let me make a couple of observations here. See, one observation is that here I just used the bound that I just held for every S, okay? But let's say if I was just caring about max 2 set, okay? So that means all the clauses are of size 2, so that means this cardinality of S is always exactly S, or sorry, is always 2. Okay, so... same analysis gives you like a more precise result for, let's say, max 2 sat or max 3 sat or what have you. So for max 2 sat, let's say E2 sat, it's actually, you get 1 minus, well, in this case, you have 1 minus 1 over 2 squared, 1 minus that, So that's 3/4. So this is a 3/4 beta approximation. Just a little better. Yeah. So actually, maybe I want to say, good point. So this is not a big success, exactly as Libor says, because the random choice would also give you 3/4. So I shouldn't have written this E, because, well, maybe there's a little bit to check here, but the point is that both the curve for S equals 1 and the curve for S equals 2 are above the 3/4 line. So this also gives you 3/4 for just max 2 set, where you can have clauses of size 1 and clauses of size 2. And that is a success, because the trivial random algorithm, if there's clauses of size 1, might only give you half approximation. But still, this exactly highlights something that's a bit weird. So, okay, we got a pretty good, you know, there's a 3/4 approximation for E2 sat, and now we got it when there's clauses of size 1 and 2. Well, there's something funny. So the, you see the, this algorithm does better if the clauses are short. Okay, because these curves sort of get lower and lower as S increases. On the other hand, the trivial algorithm, random algorithm, where you just assign every variable 50-50 rather than with mu v, does better if the clauses are all long. Okay, because then, in particular, you know, this works for, let me call it less than or equal to 2 sat. And, you know, for, to invent some notation for max greater than or equal to 2 sat, where all the clauses are of length at least 2, you can get a 3/4 approximation with the trivial random algorithm. So you might ask, can I get the best of both worlds? And the answer to that is yes, and it's one of the exercises in the lecture notes. It's quite easy. So here's the theorem. Let me write it out here. We know that if we use the LP sort of variable distributions as a guide and just output 0, 1 exactly according to them, then it's a 3/4 approximation for small clauses. And if we don't use it as a guide at all, and we just always do it 50-50, that's the trivial random algorithm, it's a 3/4 approximation if all the clauses are at least 2. So a natural idea is to sort of go halfway between these two. So if we change this line to you know, set f of b to be 1 with probability, well, the average of a half and mu v of 1, then actually you can put 3/4 here. Okay, so this algorithm sort of half uses the solution as a guide and half goes with trivial random. Actually does pretty well. It gets 3/4 factor approximation for a max set. Okay, so I won't prove that, but you can prove it fairly easily. Sort of. So, well, actually, no. So I'll say some more things. So, in the particular case of 2-sat, in particular, this gives you 3/4. And it's known as a result of Lewin, Livnat, and Zwick that for 2-sat, you can get 0.940 here, which is bigger than 3/4. And that uses semi-definite programming, this generalization of linear programming I'll talk about next. So using a more powerful algorithm, you get a better result here. There's a few more results. So actually, for 3-sat, you can get 7/8 here, which is not trivial. If it was E3 sat, so all the clauses of length 3, the trivial random algorithm gets 7/8. But if you have a mixture of 1, 2, and 3, you can still get 7/8. That's the result of Karloff and Zwick. But again, it requires semi-definite programming. And probably one could conjecture that for max sat in general, you can also get 7/8 factor rather than 3/4, but that's open. The best factor known is 0.833, also with semi-definite programming. Hardness, you mean? Well, for 3 or higher, for 3-sat, or even for E3-sat, we have hardness of host that's hardness is 7/8 plus epsilon 1 is hard, even for E3 sat. For 2 sat, it's a weaker result. It's, I don't remember, there's two funny numbers that are like maybe 21 over 32 versus 22 over 32 or something. So I don't know, it's not a very strong result. Yeah? Yeah. Yep. Good, good, good. Yeah, let me clarify that again. So the original thing with just the most naive rounding, you just round according to this, gets 1 minus 1 over E for max sat for any clause length or whatever. If you just focus for a second on 2 sat, so clauses of length 1 and 2, then this analysis I gave will immediately give you 3 quarters for that case. And the final thing, which I did in a bit, you know, naughty way by revising this board, is that actually for any max sat, this revised algorithm also gets 3 quarters. Okay. So linear programming is this is an example of like a nice approximation algorithm you can get using the linear programming approach. And I hinted about the stronger approach, which I'll talk about shortly. But I'd like to say a little bit more about why we need a stronger approach in this case. So you might ask, okay, I mean, you know, first I took this one algorithm, and I got 1 minus 1 over E, and then I revised it, and I got like 3 quarters. Like maybe I can just, you know, revise it somewhere else. I can somehow else I can get something more clever here and maybe get an even better algorithm, a better approximation guarantee. So in fact, I'll show you that that's not the case. That's not possible. This brings us to the subject of linear programming gaps. So let's look at another way to state what we just proved. So a corollary of what we just proved is the following fact. So for any instance of I, an instance of max sat, well, we know this fact, right, that the optimum value of I is less than or equal to the LP optimum of I, because the linear programming relaxation is the relaxation of the actual optimization problem. What we've just shown here is that it's not too much bigger. So we've just precisely shown that this is at most 4/3 times the opt of I. Just revising, we've shown that the opt is at least 3/4 of the LP opt, right? Because we've shown that whatever the LP opt is, this algorithm will actually produce you a solution with value at least 3/4 of that. So particularly the optimum had better be at least 3/4 of that. Okay. So particularly we've shown that this relaxation is a fairly tight relaxation. I mean, it's pretty closely related to the actual optimum. Okay, and we might naturally ask, you know, just what I said before, like maybe it's even tighter, maybe even better approximation, like maybe we can decrease this factor. And the terminology gap, an LP gap, just terminology for showing that results like this can't be improved. So I'll make a definition. So an alpha beta gap instance for CSP gamma is an I, an instance I, such that the optimum value of the instance is at most alpha, but the optimum of the LP relaxation is at least beta. Okay, so it's an instance that's showing that this gap can actually be large. Okay, and I mean, precisely what this is saying is that if such an existence gap exists, So, if such an eye exists, it means that the basic LP is not an alpha beta distinguishing algorithm. Basically, the LP can't tell the difference between these two cases. And roughly speaking, you know, that means that you're never going to be able to sort of use this linear program that I'm now erasing to come up with an alpha beta approximation algorithm that's better than the gap. The worst gap. So let me do it for two set. Okay, so this is 3/4 1 gap instance for E2 set. It's going to be an instance where the optimum is 3/4, but the LP value is 1. I really shouldn't have erased the LP. Oh well. Here it is. It's got 4 clauses. X or Y, X bar or Y, X or Y bar, X bar or Y bar. Very simple instance, 4 clauses. So let's check. Let's first check that the opt is at most 3/4. Well, that's clear, right? It doesn't matter how you assign the variables x and y, one of the clauses is going to be wrong. Okay, so you'll always get, in fact, you'll always get 3/4 no matter what assignment you use. Is that okay? Now, we also need to check that the LP value is 1, or the LP optimum value is 1. So what do we need to do? We have to produce these variable distributions and these constraint distributions that sort of give you value 1. So here I'll give you the LP solution. Okay, so we need a variable distribution for x and a variable distribution for y. So I'm going to take those both to be sort of 50-50 on 0 and 1. Half-half, I guess. Okay, and same for mu dot y. So in the LP solution, it's going to sort of fractionally assign or fuzzily assign half probability to 0 and half probability to 1. Okay. So now we also have to come up with constraint distributions. So let's call these clauses C1, C2, C3, and C4. So you need to come up with constraint distributions. So let's just focus on C2, and you can do the other ones yourself. So we need a distribution on the 4 possible assignments to x and y. And on one hand, it should be sort of consistent with these choices that we're thinking about x and y as both being 50-50, 0, 1. But it also should be totally supported on satisfying assignments because we want this constraint distribution to contribute 1 to the LP value. So can anybody see a distribution on assignments to x and y which has these two properties? It's supported on satisfying assignments and it gives 50% probability of 0 and 50% probability of 1 to x, and the same for y. Half on 0, 0, and half on 1, 1. Yeah, that looks pretty good. Yep. I should have chosen C1, it'd be more illustrative, but anyway, C2. Yeah, half, take half probability on 0, 0, and half probability on 1, 1. And 0 probability on 0, 1, and 0 probability on 1, 0. So that's a distribution on the 4 assignments to x and y. And indeed, you can see under this distribution, the first column, or the first x gets 0 with probability half, y gets 0 with 1 with probability half, and same with y. But both these assignments are satisfying. Yeah. And you can similarly do the same for C3 and C4 and C1. And you'll get like a perfect LP solution, an LP solution with value 1. So So you can give a quarter to every assignment. That would be fine. So, it would be something. And that would satisfy, that would be like a valid solution because it would satisfy this marginals condition. You'd still be giving probability mass half to zero for x and half to zero, one for x, and similarly for y. But then you'd have probability mass one quarter on an unsatisfying assignment. So you're suggesting this. It's a valid solution, but because it would put, I really shouldn't have erased the LP. Hopefully you're looking at it in the notes. Because it's putting some of its probability mass on 0, 1, this term that goes into the LP value, probability L drawn from lambda C2, but L S is in the relation, this would only be 3 quarters in this case, because only for these three outcomes of lambda sub C2 do you satisfy the relation. Okay. So this is what's called a gap instance, and in particular, it's an optimal, unfortunately, gap instance. It shows that this cannot be improved, even in the case of E2SAT, the special case of E2SAT. Okay, so in some sense, that means that if we're going to use linear programming, we've kind of analyzed how well it's going to work for E2SAT, and in fact, for all of MaxSAT as best as we can. Let me give one more example of a gap. Yeah, I know what you're saying. This does look quite unsatisfying, right? I mean, you're like, well, okay, this is one particular instance, it's on two variables. Well, I mean, yes, you can, right? I mean, you could add like 100 copies of the same thing with x1 through x100 and y1 through 100. It's still not so satisfying. So it highlights a strange thing that, if you sort of create instances of your CSP where the linear programming relaxation provably does bad, oftentimes, as a human, you look at them and say, come on, that's actually an easy instance. Like, I could make a little twist on my algorithm that would handle it. Yeah, that's possible, but still, nevertheless, it's hard to sort of give a generic algorithm that solves any old case. Let me make one more observation about linear programming, and it's about the max cut problem. One of my favorite problems. It's, again, so simple. There it is. Finding the maximum cut in a given graph. A graph can have a maximum cut value of lots of different things. But I claim that for every graph in the world, for all graphs, the LP optimum value is 1. Okay. So there's a perfect linear programming relaxation solution for every graph. And I'll quickly justify that to you. Here it is. For all vertices, it's quite similar to this, actually. For all vertices in the graph, we'll define the variable distribution, a vertex distribution, to again be 50-50 on 0 and on 1. Okay, and now we need a distribution for every edge. We need a constraint distribution. For all edges and E, we need a distribution on this, which is an assignment to the 0 and 1 for the two endpoints. And we'll take half on 0, 1, and half on 1, 0. So it's a valid assignment because, indeed, here it's consistent with that. It has half probability mass on 0 and 1 for the first vertex and same for the other vertex. But it also has, 100% of its probability mass on satisfying assignments for a cut. So that's extremely disappointing looking. It says that the LP solution and the LP optimum is telling you absolutely no useful information about the maximum cut in a given graph. Okay, so that means that the LP is the linear programming relaxation is terrible for maximum cut, which motivates talking about the semi-definite programming relaxation, which is a better and a useful approximation, sorry, relaxation of max cut. Any questions about this still? Yeah. Yes, that's a good point. So good point. So all this while, I've been talking about one specific LP relaxation. I said, take your CSP instance and use this one recipe for making a linear program out of it and analyzing it. And this is quite a generic one. It's kind of a standard one, but as Igor is suggesting, it's not the only thing you can do. You can actually add often more constraints into your linear program, and this can actually make it better sometimes. And this can get around this terrible situation for some graphs. But actually, there are theorems showing that even if you add like tons and tons, even sub-exponentially many extra constraints to the LP for max cuts, there'll still be graphs that have LP value 1 minus epsilon, even though the optimal value is a half plus epsilon. So it seems that to do well for the particular problem of max cuts, you really can't use linear programming. You're really going to have to go to something more powerful, sort of fundamentally different, semi-definite programming, rather than just adding in extra constraints. Yeah, was that a question? Exactly right. Yep, exactly right. Okay. All right, on to semi-definite programming. So, in semi-definite programming, okay, so for every constraint satisfaction problem, I told you the generic basic linear programming relaxation for it. And there is a straight generalization of that to a so-called semi-definite program. You can try to analyze for your favorite CSP. You can take your favorite CSP and write generically down this recipe for it called semi-definite programming relaxation and try to analyze that. It's kind of complicated. It's more complicated than the linear program. So that's in the notes, and I discussed it in the notes, and maybe we'll get time for it, but maybe not. So what I'm going to do is present the semi-definite programming relaxation in the specific case of the max cut problem. Okay, which is real nice because it's the simplest possible one, right? It's Boolean, it's binary. But if you have ambitions above and beyond max cuts, then you can think about the semi-definite programming relaxation I write in the notes for a generic CSP. Okay, so now I'm just going to straight up tell you what it is, and it's some kind of optimization problem, which is a relaxation of the optimization problem of max cuts, and it's going to look really weird if you haven't seen it before, but I'll talk about it. Okay. So so this is the SDP relaxation. For instance, G equals VE of max cut. It's proposed in like 1993 by Delorme and Poljak, and came really close to like analyzing and getting all the results that I'm going to tell you, but they didn't quite do it. And the fellows that did do it were Gomans and Williamson in 94, and so this semi-definite programming relaxation has come to be named after them. So this is also called the GW for Gomans Williamson SDP relaxation for max cut. Okay, here it is. So you want to maximize this thing. So okay, I'll call it SDP value of some solution. So I'll write script X for the solution. I'll tell you what it's composed of in a second. This is, again, a similar thing. You average over all the constraints, which are now edges. So it's the average over all edges UV in E of the following thing. I better just write it down. Half minus a half times the inner product of vector XU and vector XV. Those are vectors, and the angle brackets are inner products in the linear algebra sense. Subject to the solution script X is a collection of vectors, a collection of n-dimensional vectors. N is the number of vertices, in Rn, with that are unit vectors, actually. So the inner product of this vector with itself, which is also squared length, is 1. Okay. So, well, this is an optimization problem. I'll talk about it in great detail. You're given, yeah?
Vectors
Sorry, I should clarify. Each XV is a vector in Rn. Okay. So, n is the number of vertices, right? So, you're given the graph, and for each vector, sorry, for each vertex V in the graph, you're trying to associate to it a unit vector in Rn. That's the only constraint. You just give a unit vector in Rn for every vertex. And the quality of this in the STP has something to do with the inner product between these vectors, which, you know, they're all unit vectors. They're all sitting on the sphere, so their inner product is basically somehow related to their angle, right? So I'll draw a picture. So we have some graph. Here's the unit sphere in Rn. Here's the origin. And for each vector, each vertex, V, you're going to have some vector X of V. So maybe this is XU. Maybe this is X V. Maybe there's some like XW here, and so forth. And what intuitively are you trying to do in this optimization problem? This whole quantity is big. It's close to 1 if this inner product is close to negative 1. Okay? This is half minus half times this inner product. The inner product, of course, is going to be between 1 and minus 1. And if this is close to negative 1, then you get a number that's, the overall number that's close to 1. So what it's saying is that for every edge, UV in the graph, you're trying to arrange the vectors, XU and XV, have inner product minus 1. So they're almost antipodal, well, as close to antipodal as possible. Okay? So this would be pretty good, right? Because these guys have an inner product which is sort of large and negative. Okay? You're trying to spread out all the vectors corresponding to an edge. And conversely, it's quite terrible if, you know, if UW is an edge, that's not so good here, because these guys have inner products probably close-ish to 1, so they're contributing something small, half minus a half, almost 1, to the STP value. Okay. So I'll make some remarks here. So there's one super remarkable fact, which is that you can actually solve this optimization problem efficiently in P. Which looks kind of crazy, because, I mean, you're optimizing over collections of n vectors in n-dimensional space. Seems much harder at first sight than, you know, just the max cut problem itself. But believe it or not, you can actually solve it. And you can find the optimizing vectors and the optimal value. So there's an extremely tiny caveat. You can't solve it exactly. You'll get the correct value up to, let's say, plus or minus epsilon in running time poly log 1 over epsilon. So you can get sort of exponentially close to the, additively, to the correct answer. But I'm just going to ignore that and think you can solve it efficiently, which is more or less true. Why can you solve it efficiently? I mean, it looks kind of crazy. I won't have time to get into that. I wrote about it in the notes. Basically, you can actually show that this crazy optimization problem is like a linear program in disguise. It's actually truly, literally, a linear program with infinitely many constraints. But nevertheless, again, with the theory of linear programming, you can still solve this problem. Okay, so if you want to learn more about why, you can take a look at the notes. But we'll just, again, take this as a black box. This is something you can do. Actually, in general, semi-definite programming, it's exactly like linear programming, except that instead of having linear inequalities and equalities on real variables and trying to maximize a linear function of real variables, instead, you have linear equalities and inequalities on inner products of vectors. You're trying to maximize a linear function of inner products of vectors. So these are the constraints. This is a very simple one. There's equality with 1 on this inner product of vectors. And this is the thing you're trying to optimize. Yeah, Libor. I'll tell you. So for the generic CSP, basically what you'll have is a vector x, v, comma, l for all v and v and l in the domain. You'll have some constraints about the inner products of these guys that are sort of analogous to this. And you'll also have some, you'll actually, again, literally have the same local distribution random variables that are just real numbers, like before, just as in the LP. And instead of having, before we had the variable distributions and the local constraint distributions, and they're tied together by consistency constraint. In the generic SDP, we again have the local distributions on constraints, but somehow these take the place of the variable distributions, and there's some kind of consistency condition that ties these vectors together with the local distributions on constraints. You won't have vectors for the local distributions. Those will again just be actual distributions, which you can think of as collections of real numbers, one for each variable in the domain. And actually, the thing you're trying to optimize will be exactly the same as in the LP. But instead of distributions on D for each variable V, you'll have these like weird collections of vectors, and there'll be something tying these vectors together with the local distributions on the constraints. There'll be some vector variables, which will be these guys, and you'll again have the lambda C's. And these are, they're basically scalars. I mean, this is again a probability distribution on assignments S to D, which is, yes, the collection of D to the cardinality of S real numbers. No, that's a good question. So, the input to the semi-definite program is the graph. Okay, so basically the edge structure of the graph.
Okay, so and
good, so that's what the SDP gives you.
Okay.
So, the SDP with the semi-definite program, which you can just black box in your head at some like polynomial time algorithm that you can run, takes as input the graph, and it solves this optimization problem. So it gives back to you these unit vectors, one for each variable in the graph. And this quantity will be some number, which is the thing it's trying to optimize. And then you still have, you're not done. It's much like in the linear program. Now you come to sort of the creative part of the algorithm. You've got these vectors that are somehow trying to represent a cut in a weird way, and you've got to convert them into an actual cut on your graph. And again, you want to somehow creatively convert them into a cut in the graph and relate the quality of the cut you produce, presumably, to this SDP value of the vectors. No. So, this is an excellent question. It's a slightly annoying point. So, let me make one comment and then I'll come back to that. This is a good point. I'll say that again in a second, exactly what Igor said. But let me say one thing that will be important, which is that this is actually a relaxation. So this has something to do with the max cut problem. So what in particular I want to say, we always have that the opt of G, the maximum cut, is at most the SDP opt of G. Okay. So it's really a relaxation. By the way, in general, you also have this is always better than the LP relaxation. Now, in max cut, we saw that this number was always 1, so this is quite trivial. But for the general CSP, it's not trivial, but it shows that the SDP relaxation is always sort of tighter than the LP one. Okay, so let's prove this. So, what do I want to show? Basically, I need to show that, let's say, let F, mapping the vertices into 0, 1, be the optimal cut. Okay, so it has some value, which is the optimal max cut value. And now all I'm going to do is exhibit an SDP solution whose value is at least that much. Okay, and that proves that the SDP opt, whatever it is, it's certainly at least the value of F, which is the optimal value. Is that okay? Okay, so let me do one thing that will make my life easier. Yeah, thank you. I'm gonna call the domain -1, 1 instead of 0, 1. I'm just changing literally the names of the symbols in the domain. Okay. So I've got this cut, and it maps the each variable in the graph to either a vertex in the graph to either -1 or 1, and I need to produce vectors. So what I'm gonna do is just produce one dimensional vectors sitting in Rn. Okay, so I'm gonna define x sub b to be the vector f of b, comma 0, 0, 0, 0. Okay? N -1, 0. So it's a vector in Rn. So actually all my vectors are gonna be like either this guy or that guy. Okay, because this is going to be +1. So first thing to check, this is a valid solution of the LP. That's not hard. The only condition on the FTP is that all these vectors should be unit vectors in Rn, and they are. So this is defining script F. So what's this FTP value? The solution. Well, this is the solution X. Now it's the average over all edges, so u, v, and e, of ½ minus ½. Okay, now the inner product between x, v, and x, u, is, if this is x, v, I'll try to write in here, x, u is going to be f of u, all zeros. Okay, so the inner product of these two vectors is just going to be the product of these two numbers. And now remember, these numbers now are +1. So if these numbers are the same, this factor will be, let me write it, average over u and v and edge of something which is 0 if f of u equals f of v, and 1 if f of u does not equal f of v. Right, because, for example, if there are different numbers in +1, this product will be -1, so you get ½ minus ½ times -1, which is 1. Okay. So you're just taking the average of the indicator that these guys are assigned different values, so this is precisely the value of this cut. Okay, so we've shown no matter what the actual cut you have, F, even the optimal one, there's an FTP solution that has FTP value at least that. So you can always do at least as well as the maximum cut, but potentially, by virtue of these vectors being, it's getting dark in here, these guys being vectors, you can get a number which is even bigger. Okay. Okay, so let me come back to the question here about the dimension in which these vectors lie. So actually, if in this program you could insist that you got back one-dimensional vectors, then you'd actually be happy. In fact, if you could insist that the vectors you get back are one-dimensional vectors, then you're actually, it's the same as the max cut problem. You're really literally solving the max cut problem. So that's not be hard. So you can tell in advance that you cannot make the FTP do that. So it's like, sadly, the FTP may give you back n-dimensional vectors. In fact, you can think of the FTP as giving you back sort of arbitrarily dimensional vectors. But actually, as Igor pointed out, the only thing that really matters in this semi-definite program is the angles between the vectors, right? That's the only thing that's really relevant, these inner products between them. So if you have n vectors in arbitrary dimensional space, but you only care about their angles, you can sort of always rotate them to be an n-dimensional space. If you don't follow that observation, it doesn't matter, but this is not so important, but it isn't crucial that you can't do anything about it. It might be really large. Okay. Good. Any questions so far? So I told you, yeah. That's an excellent question. So as you suggested, I'm not a practitioner, but these are rumors that I hear. The rumors that I hear is that linear programming is practical, I mean, in theory and in practice. I mean, you can really solve huge linear programs. Let's say for associated CSPs, you can do it. As for FTPs, it seems that although you can do it in polynomial time in theory, in practice, not so well. It doesn't work so well. For this, for the special case of Maxcut and this Cohen-Williamson relaxation, it's simple enough that I think I understand that you can kind of do it okay in practice. Like some people actually, I guess in practice, do this for medium-sized things. But for more general CSPs, it's kind of a nightmare, even though polynomial time in theory, not so in practice. In fact, it's even linear time in theory, but I guess the constants are bad. But I think that's an excellent research direction. I mean, I really don't see any reason why, and there's a lot of theoretical work along these lines, why this couldn't be really efficient in practice as efficient as linear programming. That's not my area, but I think it's an excellent problem for practice. Okay, so we're sort of in the same state as we were with the linear program. We have this relaxation, and we want to sort of, you know, if we have a given graph G, we solve this relaxation, we get back these crazy vectors, and now we want to produce an actual cut, and we want to do two things. Somehow we want to use the vectors to sort of guide our choice of a cut, and we hope that the cut we produce can somehow be related to the SDP value of the vectors. Okay. So, what do Gomans and Williamson suggest? It kind of suggests the most natural thing. You're trying to produce a cut. You're trying to split these, partition these vectors into two groups. You have these variables. They're vectors now. And they suggest the following thing. Just pick a uniformly random hyperplane through the origin. Okay, so just spin a vector around and cut it with some kind of hyperplane that goes through the origin. And then all the vectors on one side, put the associated vertices on one side of the cut, and all the other vectors on the other side, put the associated vertices on the other side of the cut. Is that clear what that means? Okay. You don't actually have to do this. Actually, what does this even mean, a uniformly random hyperplane through the origin? Well, maybe we should pick its normal, actually. Z, and maybe from a spherically symmetric distribution. Or a rotationally symmetric distribution. Actually, that's too many words. I mean, you just want to pick it uniformly from the sphere. Okay, and then define f of v to be the sign of the inner product of z with x of v. Okay? This is actually the exact same thing. I mean, I'm saying that this is the normal to the half space z, and you look at its inner product, the dot product of it with xv. If that's positive, put them on one side. If it's negative, put them on the other side. That's the algorithm. It's quite similar. In a way, it's quite similar to the, well, sort of similar to the linear programming random rounding algorithm. We took this solution, these vectors, and we did a pretty natural thing to just convert them into actual assignments. Any questions? Does anybody know how in practice you get a random vector from the surface of the sphere?
Can you take the Gaussian distribution
Yes, excellent answer. You you take a Gaussian distribution independently for each component. That gives you a spherically symmetric distribution. It's easy to check. It's not actually on the sphere, but you could normalize it if you want. Although you don't even have to, since you're just going to be taking the sign in the end. And I don't bring this up for you know, any old reason or for fun. Actually, for more general successful SDP rounding algorithms, they're very intimately connected to the Gaussian distribution. This is a very common first step. Take a random Gaussian vector z and somehow intermingle it with the vectors to get an actual assignment. Yeah. Not sure. I mean, I don't know. See, immediately see how to see the variable distributions as unit vectors. Yeah, I have to think about that. Well, you can actually see it as, and I hope to get 2 minutes to say something about this, is you can see it as somehow applying the majority polymorphism for max cut, you know, two colorability, to the vectors. Because somehow this, taking the sign of the sum of a bunch of numbers is sort of similar to taking, well, it's the same as taking the majority of the numbers if there's plus or minus one. So that's a connection with the algebra world and polymorphisms, which is currently unclear, but an interesting one. Okay, anyway, let me go on and analyze this algorithm. Okay, so we need to do a similar thing. We need to fix an edge and ask what's the probability that this algorithm, the Goldman-Williams algorithm, cuts this edge. So fix an edge, UV in the graph. And we want to figure out what's the probability that this algorithm, so really over the choice of this hyperplane or its normal z, that the algorithm cuts the edge UV. Okay. Let's look at this picture up here. U and V are two vectors in the n-dimensional space, and you're picking like a random hyperplane, and you're asking what's the probability that's going to split these two guys. And if you kind of stare at the picture for a second, or you try to convince yourself for 2 seconds, you see this really, although it's in n-dimensions, since there are only two vectors involved now, xU and xV, it's really just a two-dimensional problem. I mean, if you really think about these two vectors on the sphere, you really only matters the sort of dihedral angle between them. That's the question of whether or not the hyperplane is going to split them. I guess I'm hand-waving here, but please convince yourself that really you can imagine the picture in two dimensions. I mean, it's really you just project the whole situation into the two-dimensional hyperplane containing xu and xv. So here's maybe xu, and here's maybe xv. And this picture is living in R2 now. And what's going on is you're picking a random half-space hyperplane through the origin. So it's really you're just picking like a random... I could even use colored chalk. You're picking a random diameter of the circle. And each diameter you choose, well, you choose it sort of uniformly at random. Okay, so some of them, like this guy, did not cut them. Here they landed on the same side of the diameter, and some of them, like this guy, did cut them. Okay. So what's the probability you cut them? It's not too hard, right? So the ones where you cut them are, well, it's like this one, this one, this one, up through here. So there's actually 180 degrees of possibility for the diameter. So it's something divided by 180 degrees. And it's just the angle between them. Right? So it's just it's this. Which corresponds to sort of sense, right? If they're 180 degrees apart, they're sure, you know, they're antipodal, they're sure to be cut. If they're the same vector, they won't be cut. And this is what it is. Okay? So now we're in the same position as before. We know that actually the exact performance of the algorithm, it gives you exactly the average over all edges of this. But what are we trying to relate it to? We're trying to relate it to this. The average over all edges of half minus half times the inner product. It's just somehow similar, right? And again, we just have to do some like arithmetic or something to finish the job. That was kind of fun arithmetic, so... Well, if you have two unit vectors, right, the angle between them, their inner product is cosine of their angle, right? So the length times the cosine of the angle, so it's the inverse cosine of their inner product. Okay. Let me use the notation. Sometimes we'll use the notation rho sub uv for the inner product, xu, xv. So this is some function, right, of rho sub uv, and I'll plot it. It looks like this. Rho UV, well, rho is some inner product between 1 and minus 1, and it's the arccos function divided by pi. So you draw a cos wave, but then you turn your head like this. So here's a cos wave. That's the function. This is 1, this is a half, and this is the function arc, well, cos inverse, rho over pi. So this is the function, the probability with which you cut an edge is a function of the inner product between the vectors and the STP solution. And we want to kind of just compare it to this number, which is a half minus a half rho. Half minus a half rho is this function. This is half minus a half rho. So, yeah, you see that sometimes this curve is above half minus half rho, sometimes it's below half minus half rho. Kind of annoying. Well, just multiply this curve by a factor. I'll do a simple analysis. There's a more careful analysis in the notes, but let me do the simple analysis for the purposes of time. So here's, okay, this is another line drawn in, which is just a multiple of this line drawn so that it's always below the curve. Okay, and it turns out that this guy is 0.878 times a half minus a half rho. 0.7878 is this number I told you about at the beginning of the first lecture. And this is some other number that's like minus 0.690 or something. Okay. So, so now we set it up so that this actual curve, cos inverse rho over pi, is at least this thing. So I can write this is at least 0.878 times half minus a half. The inner product, XU, XV. Okay, and now we're all pretty much done because we know that the expected value over this Gomez-Williamson algorithm's choice of F of its value, the expected value of the average, well, of the probability, the average over the edges, UV, of the probability that UV gets cut, okay, which is the average over U and V, an edge of, it's at least 0.878 times half minus a half the inner product XU XV and we can take the 0.878 out and this is 0.878 times the STP value of this solution. So this Gomez-Williamson algorithm gives you an actual cut that in expectation is at least this 0.878 factor times the STP value. So if you solve the STP to optimality, which is what you'll do, then the STP value is the optimal value, STP optimal value. So you get as a theorem, the expected value is at least 0.878 times the STP optimum value of G, which, since we know it's a relaxation, I don't know if that's still on the board. Yeah, it's up there. It's at least 0.878 times the opt. So in particular, therefore, it's a 0.878 beta approximation for all beta. And with this, similar to the linear programming thing, you can analyze this a bit more carefully, and you can get, for any value beta, some particular function of beta here. In particular, one thing that's nice is that if this beta is 1 minus epsilon, you can get something like 1 minus O of root epsilon here. So it says if you have an almost bipartite graph, this Gomez-Williamson algorithm will give you an almost bipartition. Okay. sound to be some questions at this point. In some ways, no. I mean, I can, but well, that's where one requires creativity. I mean, so you get back. You can look at the CPU relaxation as it's written in the notes, but for a general CSP, you'll get back a bunch of vectors, and somehow you have to, you know, a vector actually, as I said, some x, v, comma, l. For all v and v, and l in the domain, somehow you have to convert these to, you know, actual assignments. And there's lots and lots of papers about, you know, for this CSP, like 2SAT, max die cut, 3CSP, 3LIN, all these things about, you know, here's my clever way of doing that. And they do a clever way, and it's more complicated than this, and the analysis is more complicated, and they get something. There's this result of Raghavendra that I mentioned, which is about proving, mostly about proving hardness of approximating CSPs, but one component of it, and maybe Venkat will sort of mention this, is that he also came up with a generic algorithm for converting a vector solution into a actual assignment. So, you know, sort of this recipe that I've illustrated for FTP had like one standard thing, you just write this FTP relaxation down, then you use, you know, your creativity to convert the vectors into a actual solution. And he sort of, you know, gave you a recipe for the second part. He said, use this standard recipe to always convert your vectors to a solution this way. And the amazing thing about his results is he showed that whatever his two-part recipe gives is the best thing you can do in polynomial time, approximation-wise, assuming the unique games conjecture. So he shows that, you know, here's the, you don't need creativity anymore, just do this second piece, this rounding from vectors to an actual assignment, and that's the best you can do, assuming this notorious and controversial conjecture. One can also add that this second piece that he does to convert the vectors to assignments is very ugly. I mean, you choose like a huge number of Gaussian random variables, and you dot them with the vectors, and then you search over all possible functions from like R, you know, a million into